Chapter 3. The First Economic Hitman. My relationship with Claudine generated the darkest inner conflicts I had ever experienced. She seduced me in just about every way a man can be seduced, although I was a willing accomplice. She offered things I craved: liberation from the puritanical mores of my parents, adventure and romance, mentoring and physical intimacy beyond my wildest fantasies. At the same time, I could sense that I was selling my soul to the world of the economic hitman. I betrayed my wife and most of the principles I had espoused all my life. It was 1971. I had just been hired by Maine, a firm of about 2,000 professionals that consulted to governments and corporations. My boss emphasized that the company prided itself on discretion. Our clients expected us, like their attorneys and psychotherapists, to honor a strict code of absolute confidentiality. Talking with the press was simply not tolerated. As a consequence, hardly anyone had ever heard of us, other than those we served. Under different circumstances, meeting Claudine as I did might have aroused my suspicions, but I had already experienced the company's unorthodox methods. I was seated at a table in the Boston Public Library, just down the street from Maine's headquarters in the Prudential Center, when I was distracted by a gorgeous brunette wearing a dark green suit. As she sauntered into the room, strolled along the stacks of books, and sat down on the opposite side of the table, I pretended not to notice. Knowing that she was studying me both excited and confounded me. I had been raised the son of a teacher in a New Hampshire boys' private boarding school and had never overcome a feeling of awkward incompetence around beautiful women. Although I resisted the temptation to look directly at her, I was terribly aware of her shapely legs. She crossed, uncrossed, and recrossed them several times while I tried to focus ever more intently on the World Bank statistics about Kuwait open before me. Then she stretched and, without saying a word, rose from her chair. She just stood there for a long moment, gazing down at me. I studiously turned several pages in my book. To my chagrin, I nearly knocked it to the floor. She laughed, a low, purring sort of laugh. I had no choice but to glance up at her. She resembled, I thought, Gina Lola Brigida. She raised a finger to her lips, smiled sweetly, came around the table, and stuck a book under my nose. It contained a table with information about Indonesia and a card that read, "Claudine Martin, Special Consultant, CT Maine, Inc." I stared into her eyes, the same emerald color as her suit. She extended a hand and then sat down in the chair beside mine. She whispered, which seemed natural in that hushed library, that she had been assigned to help in my training, adding that she would prepare me for my first assignment. "You're headed to Jakarta," she said in a voice that would have lured the most stalwart Ulysses to the sirens. She reached across me and closed the book I had been studying. "No more Kuwait." She took my hand and gently led me out to the hallway where she handed me another card. This one had a handwritten address on the back. "My apartment," she said. "Come there tomorrow at noon." I was quite literally struck dumb. She brushed my arm with her hand. "I know this must seem very strange," she admitted, "like a dream, but it happens." She started to turn as if to leave. "Tomorrow, then?" I managed a nod. "Oh, yes, one more thing. Please don't mention this to anyone. Not even your wife." Before that first session ended the next afternoon, we were lovers. After that, we met regularly in Claudine's Beacon Street apartment. She reinforced what I already knew about Maine by emphasizing that we needed to keep everything that happened between us highly confidential. She reiterated on numerous occasions that I was a married man. "I'll never do anything to hurt your marriage," she assured me. "But even with your closest male friends, this must be our secret. That encounter at the library ought to clue you in to the importance of secrecy." Then she started to teach me about economic hitmen. She explained that our profession dated back to a pivotal event in the early 1950s. I don't suppose anyone recognized it at the time, but Eisenhower's decision changed international politics from then on, forever. Unfolding a map, she described Iran as a crucial piece on the Cold War chessboard. The country's loaded with oil, but, she pointed at the map, even more important, look at its immediate neighbors. Soviet Union, Turkey, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Besides that, whoever controls Iran rules the Persian Gulf, Arabian Gulf if you speak Arabic, and can easily attack Israel, Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria with missiles. She went on to say that in the 1951 democratic elections for prime minister, Iranians chose Mohammad Mossadegh, Time magazine's Man of the Year in 1951, a prominent parliamentarian who promised to force foreign oil companies to share more of their profits with the Iranian people or face expropriation. He honored his campaign promise. She refolded the map. The bastard nationalized Iran's petroleum assets. Then she grinned and incurred the wrath of British and U.S. intelligence. A big mistake. Claudine spent the rest of the afternoon summarizing the politics of the Cold War in the Middle East. The United Kingdom and the United States, she said, shared a strong bond after World War II and also a sense of vulnerability over the threat of losing petroleum reserves to the Soviet Union. After Mossadegh nationalized oil, the CIA's director, Alan Dulles, demanded action. However, because of Iran's proximity to the USSR, President Eisenhower ruled against risking a nuclear war by launching an invasion. Instead, a CIA agent named Kermit Roosevelt, Teddy's grandson, was dispatched with several million dollars. He hired a band of thugs to disrupt the country. Riots and violent demonstrations followed, creating the impression that Mossadegh was both unpopular and inept. In 1953, he was overthrown, imprisoned for a while, and then spent the rest of his life under house arrest. The CIA's choice for a replacement, the pro-oil company, pro-Washington Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, was brought in and crowned Shahan Shah, King of Kings. "You're telling me," I asked when she finished, "that our CIA ousted a democratically elected head of state?" She tossed back her auburn hair and laughed. "Of course. Surely this isn't the first time you've heard that." I admitted that I had read about Mossadegh and others, leaders in Guatemala, Chile, and several African countries, who had gone down in coups suspected of being CIA operations. But I protested, I never really believed it, or if I gave it much thought at all, I figured they were real threats to us. "Well, you're right there. Those men were real threats. We must be vigilant always. Communism will stop at nothing. Besides, the Shah delivered. He welcomed our oil companies with open arms and awarded thousands of lucrative contracts to U.S. corporations." We discussed the broader implications that Kermit Roosevelt's gambit reshaped Middle Eastern history and at the same time rendered obsolete all the old strategies for empire building. Washington learned that one man with a few million dollars could accomplish a task that previously had been left to armies and had cost billions. Roosevelt had transformed Iran into a U.S. puppet, and he had done it without risking a war with Russia, or, for that matter, without most of the world, including U.S. citizens, having any notion that we had brought democracy to its knees. "There were two problems, though," Claudine told me. "First, Kermit was a card-carrying CIA agent. If he'd been caught, our government would have been terribly embarrassed, to say the least. Second, because he relied on so many untrained people, those thugs he paid, the word eventually got out. It's caused lots of resentment." She gave me a coy smile. "That's where you come in." Washington devised a brilliant solution, one that was consistent with the growing trend toward privatization. It would hire contractors like Maine to do the dirty work rather than government employees. And, she added, we didn't want to rely on inciting riots. A better alternative was to corrupt officials before they ever threatened nationalization. Claudine typically began our meetings with lovemaking, once confiding, you're a better student when your libido is satisfied. But one afternoon she announced that things would be different that day. She was dressed in blue jeans and a pullover sweater, not one of her more revealing outfits. Pure business today, she informed me. This lesson is critical. She took my hand and led me to an overstuffed leather chair. But if you absorb it like a good student... She left me at the chair and sat down on a sofa facing me. Time to talk about you, she said. She told me that my objective was the same as Kermit Roosevelt's, to bring countries with resources our corporations coveted, like oil, a canal, or cheap labor, into our fold. As a precaution against the type of situation Kermit faced, where a leader had already defied us, I would start by developing economic studies that justified huge loans to the targeted country. Bechtel, Halliburton, and other U.S. companies would be hired to build infrastructure projects. When the country can't pay, you demand a pound of flesh. That's what I'll be expected to do in Indonesia? You bet. It's the reason you get paid the big bucks, fly first class, stay in the best hotels. It's a critical country, like Iran. The main island, Java, is the most heavily populated piece of real estate on the planet. Indonesia's got the largest concentration of Muslims in the world, and it happens to sit on a sea of oil. It's the place where communism must be stopped, the next domino after Vietnam. We must win the Indonesians over. She showed me a cartoon she had clipped from a newspaper. A wolf was rushing into a herd of elk, creating turmoil. Two other wolves, an adult and a pup, were sitting quietly to the side. After your dad's terrified and exhausted him, the older wolf explained, we'll go in and save the day. Then we'll have our pick for dinner. That pretty much sums up what we do, Claudine said. She handed me two books, A Theory of the Consumption Function and Capitalism and Freedom. This week's reading, not exactly James Bond. I perused their covers. Both were by Milton Friedman. But if you understand them, she continued, you'll get to live like James Bond, without, of course, the pens that convert to missiles. Those books introduced me to the theories I would apply in many third world countries during the next decade. Thanks to Claudine and Milton, I grew proficient at my job. My life did begin to resemble Bond's, at least as far as the hotels, booze, and women were concerned. I was made chief economist. I headed up a staff of highly skilled economists, financial analysts, management consultants, regional planners, and even a sociologist, and I became the firm's youngest partner in its 100-year history. Looking back, I see that I was, as Panama's Omar Torrijos said, hoodwinked. I bought into the deception that massive loans invested into heavily capitalized infrastructure projects, combined with privatization, would alleviate poverty. But while those loans and projects appeared good on paper, showing that the countries receiving them enjoyed economic growth, the part that was not disclosed was that paying off the interest meant diverting funds from healthcare, education, and other social services. The heavy debts drove more and more people into poverty and widened the gap between rich and poor. All the studies neglected to indicate that in the third world, most of the poor live outside the statistically measurable economy. They cannot afford to buy electricity or cars. They do not use ports and airports. The few who are hired by modern industrial parks often suffer from horrid working conditions, low pay, and high turnover rates. My job, as I would discover, was to hoodwink the world. I came to realize that in the third world, I was both the wolf who drove the elk herd into a frenzy and the one rushing in for the kill. I had no idea at that time that the United States shares something in common with third world countries, or that at home I was one of the elks. along with nearly everyone else. And like the victims of the wolves, we were being driven toward calamity. Chapter 4. Iran and the Swirling Clouds. Returning from Indonesia, I was heartbroken to discover that Claudine had left Boston while I was away. But very soon after that, I was sent on a short trip to Panama, and then a much longer one to Iran. Both countries would have a major impact on me personally. However, at first I was particularly impressed by Iran. It was a place I had dreamed about ever since reading Rumi in high school. Claudine's accounts of intrigue around Mossadegh and the Shah had steeped an even deeper interest. During the 1970s, I traveled there many times as part of a team of foreign consultants charged with supporting the Shah and convincing him to invest his oil revenues in projects that our corporations designed, managed, and constructed. Being persuasive with potentates whose treasuries overflowed with petrodollars was different from coercing the heads of states of countries like Indonesia to use their undeveloped petroleum resources as collateral against loans. But the end result was pretty much the same. Wine them, dine them, hook them, and reel them into the fold. I helped induce the Shah's people to Americanize their country, hiring corporations ranging from the biggest, General Electric, Boeing, IBM, and Citibank, to the small innovative firms coming out of Berkeley and Cambridge that specialized in new high-tech fields. Like many others, we at Maine ignored the mounting unrest, the signs that the Shah's brutal dictatorship was turning his former supporters against him and us. For me, this refusal to read the signs of the impending eruption lasted nearly a decade. Then suddenly, everything changed. One evening in 1978, while I was sitting at the luxurious bar in the Hotel Intercontinental Tehran, I was contacted by an Iranian friend I had not seen since my college days. He had been hired to convince me to leave Iran, quickly. Both of us were on the next flight to Rome. 2 days later, news came of bombings and riots. Ayatollah Khomeini and the mullahs had begun their offensive. Over the next months, the Shah fled, was diagnosed with cancer, took refuge in Egypt and Panama, and died. The mullahs railed against U.S. imperialism, calling Kermit Roosevelt Satan's agent, and accusing Washington of crimes against the Iranian people and humanity. Their followers stormed the U.S. embassy in Tehran, took 52 Americans hostage, and held them for 444 days. Most U.S. businesses were locked out of Iran for 3 decades. There's no doubt that the 1979 Islamic Revolution was rooted in the 1953 coup, former CIA agent Bob Baer told me. A lauded operative, awarded the CIA's Career Intelligence Medal, Bob did not look much like George Clooney, the actor who played him in the 2005 Academy Award-winning movie Syriana that was based on Bob's books See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil. Bob was handsome, but not in Clooney's attention-luring manner. Bob and I were drinking beers at a South Florida tiki bar one Sunday afternoon in 2007. He was in the process of completing The Devil We Know, dealing with the new Iranian superpower, and Iran was very much on his mind. Kermit impacted the entire region and the world. I think we can safely say that there's a direct line from him through the Shah and the Islamic Revolution to Al-Qaeda. We talked that afternoon about how different the Middle East might look now if we had supported Mossadegh instead of overthrowing him, and how encouraging the democratically elected prime minister to use oil money to elevate Iran's people from the extreme poverty they suffered would have established a far better model than the one offered by the Shah. The conflicts between Sunnis and Shia and Arabs and Israelis might have been resolved long ago had we respected democracy and allowed the region to use its considerable resources to alleviate poverty and suffering. I'm worried, Bob added, that 1953 will continue to haunt any progressive candidates who run for prime minister in the next elections. The June 2009 Iranian elections were viewed by the Obama administration, the U.S. Congress, and many corporate heads as offering hope for regime change. Instead, Bob's fears materialized. The world watched Iran tear itself apart. Every time I read another article about the riots and the police brutality, I thought about Kermit Roosevelt. The leaders in Iran, who defended as legitimate the election of the conservative incumbent favorite of the mullahs, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, over the more pro-Western Mir Hossein Mousavi, cited the CIA coup against Mossadegh as a reason not to bow to U.S. pressures or cooperate with Washington. It seems that Iran is a warning to us in the United States, and it has nothing to do with nuclear weapons. Iran tells us that we need to wake up to the undercurrent of discontent that surrounds us. If we make the same mistakes now that we made with Mossadegh and then throughout the Shah's regime, and if we fail to read the signs here in the United States, we are likely to find ourselves facing something every bit as tumultuous as what Iran has endured. We will not be ruled by mullahs, but the impact on our society will go far beyond the economic crises that have already hit us. The 2009 post-election events in Iran highlight the fact that the world has changed radically since that last night I was there in 1978. Back then, the Cold War raged. There were two superpowers, but that was changing rapidly. The mutant form of capitalism espoused in those two books that Claudine had given me drove the Soviet Union off the superpower list. For a while, a single country dominated, the United States. That is now ending. The planet's geopolitics have changed. We have entered a time of realignment not unlike the one that occurred when city-states joined together to form nations. Except this time, it is global. Nations are becoming less relevant. The emerging rulers are not presidents, dictators, government officials, or politicians. The rulers are corporate CEOs, members of the corporatocracy. Like huge clouds swirling around the globe, their conglomerates reach every continent, country, and village. They are unrestricted by national borders or any particular sets of laws. Although many are headquartered in the United States and call upon the U.S. military to protect their interests, they feel no sense of loyalty to any one country. They form partnerships with the Chinese and the Taiwanese, with Israel and the Arab nations, with Brazilians, Australians, Russians, Indonesians, Congolese, with anyone who possesses resources they covet. As we have seen with Halliburton, they think nothing of relocating to places like Dubai, where they pay fewer taxes. This is the world that Claudine trained me to create, the world of Milton Friedman, Ronald Reagan, the Shah of Iran, and the EHM. It was never really about the United States. It was about privatization and deregulation. The mantra, good government is less government, summed it up. The ideal was always a type of free trade, whereby the only restrictions that applied were those that favored the multinationals, and the only governments that mattered were ones that would provide soldiers to guard oil wells, dams, mines, and other corporate assets. The mutant virus took the USSR off the superpower list, and then it did the same to the United States. The ruling elites, the members of the corporatocracy, bear a disturbing resemblance to the Shah of Iran and those other dictators we empowered. Unlike elected presidents, premiers, or prime ministers, they are not chosen by the people, do not serve limited terms, and answer to no one. They profess to report to boards of directors, but they all serve on each other's boards and are mutually supportive. They wield tremendous influence in the halls of both local and national governments. Almost no politician gets elected without money that flows through them and their stockholders. They control the mainstream media, either through direct ownership or advertising budgets. I want to emphasize that I do not subscribe to a conspiracy theory. These people do not have to conspire. They do not need to commit illegal acts. Many of them have never met the majority of their peers. The figures around national campaign financing provide a blueprint of their methods. In 2008, candidates running for the U.S. House of Representatives raised $978 million for their campaigns. U.S. Senate candidates brought in $410 million, while the presidential candidates raised $1.8 billion. The vast majority of this money came from corporate donations, political action committees, PACs, and individual stockholders who contributed in the expectation of increasing company profits. There is nothing conspiratorial about this, yet it does invest corporations with a great deal of political power. The same can be said for the use of lobbyists, one of the most effective political weapons in the corporatocracy's arsenal. These men and women make sure that politicians draft laws that support corporate needs, even when those laws countermand campaign promises and disregard public opinion. Estimates of the number of lobbyists in Washington, D.C. vary, depending on congressional agendas. At any given time, there may be from 11,000 to 30,000. American University's Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies concluded in a 2006 report that $2.13 billion was spent on lobbying in 2004. One of its PhD candidates estimated that as many as 150,000 people were working to influence public policy, even though the majority were not legally classified as lobbyists. In early 2009, people around the planet attempted to figure out what had caused the worldwide financial collapse. Conclusions presented in a 231-page report issued on March 4, 2009 by Essential Information and the Consumer Education Foundation were summarized as follows. The financial sector invested more than $5 billion in political influence purchasing in Washington over the past decade, with as many as 3,000 lobbyists winning deregulation and other policy decisions that led directly to the current financial collapse. From 1998 to 2008, Wall Street investment firms, commercial banks, hedge funds, real estate companies, and insurance conglomerates made $1.725 billion in political contributions and spent another $3.4 billion on lobbyists, a financial juggernaut aimed at undercutting federal regulation. Nearly 3,000 officially registered federal lobbyists worked for the industry in 2007 alone. The report documents a dozen distinct deregulatory moves that, together, led to the financial meltdown. These include prohibitions on regulating financial derivatives, the repeal of regulatory barriers between commercial banks and investment banks, a voluntary regulation scheme for big investment banks, and federal refusal to act to stop predatory subprime lending. It should be noted that the above refers only to lobbyists employed by the financial sector. Those from many other industry groups, including energy, automobiles, military equipment, chemicals, pharmaceuticals, insurance, wholesalers, and retailers, collaborated closely with them. Communications networks work in tandem with the lobbyists. Corporatocracy dominance of the mainstream media has grown steadily, paralleling the rise of Friedman capitalism. In 1983, 50 corporations controlled the vast majority of all news media in the United States. By 1992, that had been reduced to less than 30. In 2004, only six huge corporations, Time Warner, Disney, which owns ABC, Murdoch's News Corporation, Bertelsmann of Germany, Viacom, formerly CBS, and General Electric, NBC, owned most of the industry. These conglomerates tend to favor mergers, consolidation, and bigness, while opposing attempts to regulate multinational corporations. In both their news reporting and their editorials, they promote free trade agreements, privatization, and other policies that have led to the current crises. The power wielded by the corporatocracy is global and also at times highly personal. A project manager at a major U.S. utility company has a disturbing story to tell. He informed the newspaper that his plant had not started operating on schedule because the General Electric turbine arrived late. Jack Welch, GE's CEO, called my chairman of the board, the project manager said to me, and demanded that he fire me. He did. That information spread quickly throughout the industry. It sent a strong message that anyone who criticized GE would suffer dire consequences. Shocking as that account sounds, it is not unusual. Such tactics are used regularly by people in positions of power like Jack Welch. After GE bought NBC, the word went out that covering stories critical of Welch, GE, or any of the company's largest clients was tantamount to committing career suicide. Unfortunately, such tactics are not limited to GE. Corporate intimidation can take even darker forms, including physical violence. If you talk to men and women who work for Coca-Cola in Colombia, Nike in Indonesia, or Shell in Nigeria, or to the people who slaughter chickens for Tyson, or reject Monsanto's GMO seeds in the United States, or to those who go down into coal mines in Kentucky, or climb Chevron's oil rigs in Myanmar, you are likely to conclude that methods of persuasion can be deadly. The days of club-wielding, union-busting hooligans are not over. Often such activities are contracted out to security firms that subcontract to local operators who hire non-English-speaking thugs, making it extremely difficult to ever trace responsibility back to corporate headquarters. In the secret history of the American Empire, two U.S. citizens, acquaintances of mine, Jim Keaty and Leslie Kretzu, co-founders of the nonprofit Educating for Justice, described the terrifying harassment they encountered from Nike. When they lectured at universities and high schools around the United States about their experiences living with impoverished Nike workers in Indonesia, they were subjected to attacks on their character by corporate executives in school newspapers. This escalated to physical violence in Indonesia. They, their Indonesian driver, a translator, and a cameraman were chased one night along a dark road outside Jakarta by a band of ruffians on motorcycles. "They surrounded our car," Jim said. "Our driver was forced to pull over," Leslie added. "We were hustled out at gunpoint and pushed around. Our driver was severely beaten." Intimidation is not openly taught in business schools. But, a Harvard MBA student told a group of us one night over beers in Harvard Square, "We know it is standard operating procedure at many companies." He gave us a sheepish grin. The mere suggestion titillates. Who doesn't thrill to the idea of having that kind of power and getting away with it? Members of the corporatocracy are not part of a conspiracy, but they are characterized by an obsession with winning. They will invest vast amounts of money to get their way. They also share a common goal, to maximize profits regardless of environmental and social costs. In seeking that goal, they have created an extremely unstable, unjust, and dangerous world. How did people like that gain such power? How did the rest of us allow it? Why does society continue to put up with it? These are fair questions to ask. Chapter 5. Mercenaries. A good executive is like a loyal soldier, Professor Ashton used to tell his students in Business Management 101 at Boston University. He's faithful to the cause, doesn't accept the job simply to earn a salary. He or she, glancing at the single female in our class, it was, after all, 1966, is driven by a sense of duty to long-term company growth. When I took that class, and copious notes, Professor Ashton hammered home the idea that a business person has a fiduciary responsibility. He is obligated, he would repeat time and again, to serve his customers as well as stockholders. In fact, he has a responsibility to the general populace to assure that his company operates according to the highest standards in the public interest. Corporations had been legally held to standards like those championed by Professor Ashton for more than a century after the founding of this country. States did not grant charters to companies that failed to prove they were serving the public interest, and they would shut down any companies that reneged on their promises to carry out their fiduciary responsibilities. Corporations were not permitted to purchase each other or to gain monopolistic positions by other means. All that changed during what has become known as the golden era of the robber barons. Attitudes and laws shifted radically after an 1886 Supreme Court decision that bestowed on corporations the same rights as those granted to individuals, but without the responsibilities required of individuals. Corporations could buy and sell each other and enjoy freedom of speech, including publishing misleading advertisements, and they were no longer obligated to serve the public interest. Then the pendulum swung back. The Great Depression, the New Deal, and World War II inspired government officials and corporate executives to enact laws and adopt attitudes that once again reflected a sense of national loyalty and service. During the 1933 to 1980 period, the idea of fiduciary responsibility shaped the ethics of many executives, government officials, and teachers like Professor Ashton. It came to a sudden halt with the election of President Ronald Reagan and the ascendancy of Friedman economics. Armed with the belief that profit maximization was their only obligation, company officers felt justified in doing just about anything to increase their short-term bottom lines. The focus on immediate performance fueled a disturbing new trend. CEOs adopted the self-image of superstars. If their sole purpose was to make money, they reasoned, why should they not be rewarded like the sports heroes and rock stars who were demanding a bigger share of the take from their events? Following the example of multi-million dollar NFL quarterbacks, CEOs prospered from salaries that exceeded by hundreds of times those of the guys in the front lines. The Irish organization FinFacts Ireland, using data compiled from the AFL-CIO, Business Week, and United for a Fair Economy, published an article entitled Executive Pay and Inequality in the Winner-Take-All Society in the August 7, 2005 edition of FinFacts Ireland Business News. Nobody beats the U.S. when it comes to the difference in pay between CEOs and the average worker. In 2000, on average, CEOs at 365 of the largest publicly traded U.S. companies earned $13.1 million, or 531 times what the typical hourly employee took home. The corresponding ratio in 1980 was only 42, and in 1990, it was 85. As one source has put it, in 2000, a CEO earned more in one workday, there are 260 in a year, than what the average worker earned in 52 weeks. In 1965, by contrast, it took a CEO 2 weeks to earn a worker's annual pay. U.S. CEOs' pay rose 313% from 1990 to 2003, an advocacy group UFE said. By contrast, the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index rose 242%, and corporate profits gained 128%. Business people stopped judging themselves based on their company's long-term growth or reputation in consumer polls. Instead, the measurement of their worth became a function of the salaries and bonuses they could squeeze out of the marketplace or out of the mergers, acquisitions, and other short-term deals they struck. They transformed themselves from good soldiers into mercenaries, selling themselves to the highest bidder. My professors were adamant that despite their contributions to industrial growth, men like John Jacob Astor, real estate, fur, Andrew Carnegie, railroad steel, Henry Flagler, railroads oil, Jay Gould, finance railroads, Collis P. Huntington, railroads, J.P. Morgan, finance, Leland Stanford, railroads, John D. Rockefeller, oil, and Cornelius Vanderbilt railroads were to be vilified, not hero-worshipped. Yet in 2009, it appeared their ghosts had returned. A serious problem, however, confronted these modern barons. Their salaries, bonuses, stock options, and lavish expenses, including their fleets of private jets, did not simply materialize like a genie from a lamp. They had to be squeezed out of something. That something was growth, or rather, in many cases, it was the illusion of growth. Executives expanded their companies rapidly. They neglected long-term goals in favor of short-term deals that inflated the price of their stock, along with their salaries and bonuses. As the world moved deeper into the 2000s, opportunities to create growth, or even its illusion, dried up. Markets shrank rapidly. The classic economic model of supply, S, and demand, D, curves, teaches that when production exceeds demand, prices fall until demand increases, and S and D reach equilibrium. The executives running the multinationals came up with a modification. They responded to the increasing production dilemmas, S, not just by lowering prices, the traditional approach, but by expanding markets, opening up new ones, D. They peddled their goods and services to India and Latin America. Demand shot up. They boosted production, and then had to open still more markets in Africa and China. Many of the goods and services they sold catered to purely materialistic desires, rather than meeting the real needs of feeding and clothing impoverished people, cleaning up polluted environments, or discovering non-petroleum sources of energy. Trinket capitalism was what Professor Ashton called it. He worried that ours had become an economy based to a large extent on aggressively marketing things no one really needed, and that ultimately such an economy was doomed to failure. That was in the late 1960s. Over the next decades, it got worse. Eventually, markets around the world approached saturation. The superstar executives reacted in accordance with Friedman's principles. Rather than attempting to develop new products that reflected true needs, they opted for the quickest means of making more profits. They hit upon a creative solution. Expand the money supply and the consumer's ability to purchase. They invented new forms of credit as a way of raising the D curve. Individuals and companies were encouraged to accept loans that previously would never have been approved. Laws against usurious interest rates were dropped. People began to pay as much as 35% on their credit card debts. It did not take long before thousands defaulted, then millions. One business after another stumbled into bankruptcy. In addition to devising new types of credit, executives also developed innovative ways to scam the public and the emasculated regulatory agencies. One of the most widely publicized of these was the Special Purpose Entity, SPE, created by Enron. When I was CEO of an energy company during the 1980s, and then a consultant to Stone and Webster Engineering Corporation in the 1990s, I frequently met with other energy company executives. We would start the day lounging in a boardroom, sipping coffee, and exchanging industry gossip. The conversation often turned to Enron. "Can you believe the contract they just signed in India?" someone would ask. Or, "How about that Brazilian project?" We all marveled at Enron's ability to strike mammoth deals that seemed too good to be true. No one outside the company could fathom how it operated. Enron executives and consultants gave us condescending smiles. When pressed, an insider might brag about creative financing, innovative management, and special relationships with the Bushes and other power brokers. "We're a unique company," Managing Director of Investor Relations Paula Rieker told a conference I attended. "We find the best and the brightest people, and we offer them incentives to develop the greatest and most inventive projects possible." Inventive was the key. After the company collapsed, we discovered that it had invented an illusion. The SPEs appeared profitable because they were offshore units that avoided taxation and sold assets to each other at much higher prices than any legitimate market would bear. They also granted anonymity and a freedom in currency movements that hid company losses off balance sheet. Corporate officers performed contorted financial deceptions in order to promote the impression of billions in profits while the company was hemorrhaging money. Enron filed for bankruptcy on December 2, 2001. CEO Kenneth Lay was convicted on May 25, 2006, on 10 counts of securities fraud and related charges. Paula Reeker pleaded guilty in federal court to a criminal insider trading charge. Arthur Andersen, back then one of the five largest and most respected accounting firms in the world, bought into Enron's spiral of deception, even sanctified and promoted it. As a result, in 2002, Andersen surrendered his licenses to practice as certified public accountants in the United States. The Enron-Andersen scandal created havoc throughout world financial communities. Hundreds of thousands lost their jobs, yet executives continued to assure the world that they were dedicated to stockholder interests. Not only did the Bush administration and the majority of Congress members appear to look the other way, but they also continued to promote the free market concepts that had knocked out the very regulations that once protected us from such shams. We were hoodwinked. Those people gained so much power, and we let them get away with it because they deceived us. And we cooperated. We fell for their propaganda, subscribed to trinket capitalism, accepted the idea that they did not need to be regulated, permitted them to convince us that granting them the freedom to operate unfettered somehow benefited all of us. Then, even after we knew better, we continued to put up with them because they had us. They had us just as they had the people of Indonesia, Colombia, and Nigeria. They had captured and imprisoned us in a cage of debt. We did not dare stand up to them. Ralph Waldo Emerson expressed it in the simplest possible terms in his essay, Wealth. A man in debt is so far a slave. Chapter 6. Enslaved by Debt. Ecuador's president shocked the world just before Christmas 2008. Rafael Correa, democratically elected 2 years earlier, a man who holds a Ph.D. in economics from the University of Illinois and was trained as an economist familiar with Friedman's theories, publicly proclaimed that Ecuador was not obligated to pay its national debt. The loans, he said, had been signed by unelected military dictators who were coerced by the World Bank, IMF, CIA, and people with my old job. Therefore, his country did not have to honor them. On December 13, 2008, the BBC announced, Ecuador is to default officially on billions of dollars of foreign debt it considers illegitimate, says President Rafael Correa. Mr. Correa said he had given the order not to approve a debt interest payment due on Monday, describing the international lenders as monsters. The president said that some of Ecuador's $10 billion debt was contracted illegally by a previous administration. Speaking in the city of Guayaquil, Mr. Correa said, As president, I couldn't allow us to keep paying a debt that was obviously immoral and illegitimate. The Washington Post pointed out, Ecuador is ceasing payments not because the oil-rich country cannot afford to pay, but because it has made a political decision not to. Correa has been threatening default and demonizing foreign investors since his presidential campaign in 2006. Most recently, he has cited a presidential commission report that found evidence of criminal violations. When I met with Ecuador's energy and mines minister, Alberto Acosta, shortly after Correa took office, Acosta told me, Banks that grant loans to dictators, knowing they will finance projects that benefit the rich minorities and hurt the poor majorities, have to accept the blame for much of what is wrong here in Ecuador and so many other places. After true democratic elections are held, the elected officials must stand up for the majority. Correa, a man who likes to leave his office in the government palace and wander among his people in rural villages and city slums, had read Confessions of an Economic Hitman. He too had been approached by EHNs. He knew the pressures that could be imposed on heads of state. He wrote an endorsement for The Secret History of the American Empire, calling it a significant contribution to the new universal way of searching for innovative approaches to coexistence. Those approaches included smashing the shackles of debt enslavement. The equatorial sun shone down on Quito, a city that sits atop the Andes at an altitude of 9,000 feet, as I left the government palace late in the afternoon and wandered into the Plaza de la Independencia. I headed toward the old cathedral that dates back to the 16th century. Suddenly, I was struck by a memory. I sat down on a bench, overcome by a combination of déjà vu and altitude sickness. Images flashed before me from my first days as a Peace Corps volunteer in Ecuador in 1968. Large reserves of oil had been discovered in the country's Amazon basin. Texaco was working with government officials, especially those in the military, to convince the populace that oil would elevate Ecuador from the Dark Ages to the ranks of a wealthy nation. I recalled students parading through this plaza waving banners that proclaimed, "Oil for the people," "Petroleum profits to feed the starving," and "Don't allow Yankee imperialists to imprison us." In retrospect, it seemed that they had anticipated the disaster that was about to strike their country. Then my recollections skipped ahead a year. "It's our oil, God's gift to the people of Ecuador," newly elected President Velasco Ibarra declared from the balcony of Cuenca's municipal building. "We must use this gift to make sure that the people of Ecuador reap the benefits." Ibarra's words echoed those of the students, but they did not please Ecuador's CIA-backed army. In February 1972, the president was overthrown in a coup and replaced by a military junta. After that, massive loans flooded Quito. The government hired foreign companies to build power plants, transmission lines, highways, ports, airports, and industrial parks. In essence, the Amazon, with its oil, was collateralized. The people were told that the oceans of petroleum buried beneath their jungles were more than enough to justify all the loans. At first, the students rebelled. They understood that debt was a curse. They took to the streets. I stood on a Cuenca rooftop one afternoon, observing a pitched battle in the park below between rock-hurling students and police in full combat gear. I watched in horror as a tear gas canister exploded in one student's face. The next day, I read in the newspaper that he had died. Eventually, the resistance was broken. The EHMs had a field day in Ecuador. The new dictator, General Guillermo Rodriguez Lara, began the process of obligating his country to the loans that would haunt Correa 3 decades later. Lara was an EHM's dream. He had studied at the infamous U.S. School of the Americas, a training ground located in the Panama Canal Zone for right-wing dictators and their enforcers, and he was dedicated to serving the CIA and U.S. oil companies. His nickname was Bombita, Little Bomb. His rule, and that of his successor, Admiral Alfredo Ernesto Poveda Berbano, lasted for nearly a decade, until 1979. Their policies epitomized what Torrijos so aptly defined as predatory capitalism. When petroleum prices fell, Ecuador's economy plummeted. Predictably, the corporatocracy had the country in its clutches. Over the next decades, Ecuador was forced to sell its oil at cut-rate prices to foreign companies, strike banana and shrimp trade deals that imposed hardships on Ecuadorian campesinos, vote at the United Nations in support of Washington's anti-Cuba policies, and allow the United States to build its largest Latin American military base on Ecuador's pristine coast. As onerous as all these conditions were, there was another that was even worse. In 2000, Ecuador was forced by the IMF to convert its official currency from the sucre to the U.S. dollar. The havoc this caused to people whose few savings had been held in sucres is immeasurable. The value fell from 6,500 sucres to the dollar in 1998 to the official rate of 25,000 to the dollar on the day in 2000 when everyone was obliged to convert. Millions of people in the lower and middle classes faced impending starvation. A person who thought he or she owned a dollar's worth of sucres suddenly found himself or herself with a mere 26 cents. At the other end of the spectrum, business people and foreign corporations with dollar accounts in foreign banks saw their fortunes swell overnight by nearly 400%. An estimated 3 million people, nearly a third of Ecuador's population, fled their country and flooded the illegal immigrant labor pools in the United States and Europe. There was one more thing that arguably was even more devastating to Ecuador in the long run than the currency conversion: the complete and utter destruction of an immense area of fragile rainforest and its impact on the indigenous cultures that had inhabited it for thousands of years. Texaco, the oil company that arrived in Ecuador wearing a savior's halo, had shown its true colors. It ravaged the entire northern Amazon region. Finally, legal actions were taken. As of the writing of this book, a $27 billion class action environmental lawsuit against Texaco, now owned by Chevron, for allegedly dumping more than 18 times the amount of waste spilled by the Exxon Valdez into rainforest rivers, destroying fragile Amazonian environments and killing hundreds of people through illegal toxic waste dumping, is awaiting judgment in an Ecuadorian court. Filed on behalf of 30,000 Ecuadorians, it is the largest environmental lawsuit in the history of the planet. Ecuador is a classic case, but it is just one of many. Over the years, unelected dictators have been placed into power through the clandestine efforts of multinational corporations, international banks, and the CIA. The Shah of Iran, Suharto of Indonesia, Augusto Pinochet of Chile, Anastasia Somoza of Nicaragua, Anwar Sadat of Egypt, Jonas Savimbi of Angola, Mobutu Sese Seko of Zaire, Congo, the House of Saud of Saudi Arabia, to name a few. The citizens are not involved in making or accepting the deals these leaders sign that leave their countries awash in debt. By the time the people become aware of what has hit them, those responsible typically have absconded with their fortunes to enjoy luxurious lives in Miami, the French Riviera, Morocco, or some other safe haven. And the citizens of their country are told by the IMF and its affiliates that they are responsible for paying back the loans. These impacts were expressed in a recent Foreign Policy in Focus article. Like many of the victims of the U.S. subprime mortgage mess, the Ecuadorian people were the targets of predatory lending. In the 1970s, unscrupulous international lenders facilitated some $3 billion in borrowing by Ecuadorian dictators, who blew most of the money on the military. After the transition to democracy, the Ecuadorian people got stuck holding the bag. Over the years, the country has made debt payments that exceed the value of the principal it borrowed, plus significant interest and penalties. But after multiple reschedulings, conversions, and some further borrowing, Ecuador's debt has risen to more than $10 billion today. The human costs are staggering. Every dollar sent to international creditors means $1 less is available for fighting poverty. And in 2007, the Ecuadorian government paid $1.75 billion in debt service, more than it spent on healthcare, social services, the environment, and housing and urban development combined. An old silent movie I saw at a college film festival depicts the tragic consequences of debt. A farmer is seated at a table on the decrepit porch of his home, his wife and beautiful daughter beside him. He holds a pen, poised to write. A banker hovers behind the family, peering lecherously at the daughter. The farmer turns to his wife, a questioning expression on his face. She gives him a look of total defeat. On the black screen, the words, "We have no choice," appear. He bends over a paper on the table and signs his name. The banker snatches the paper and bows to the daughter, who shrinks behind her mother. As the banker skulks away, he peers into the camera and sneers. The caption on the screen reads, "I've got that girl now. They'll never be able to pay." The screen goes black. A caption appears. 3 months later, the banker returns to the farm. The family is huddled together just outside their door. The farmer steps forward and spreads his arms wide. The camera pans to fields that are scorched and lifeless. The farmer drops to his knees and wrings his hands. The banker grabs the daughter and leads her down the steps. Fade to black. That movie, shot nearly a century ago, was intended as a warning. Yet people around the world continue to be coerced and seduced into taking on more debt. The sad truth is that people, even today, are literally forced to sell their daughters. On August 8, 2008, England's Herald reported, "Some 600,000 people are illegally trafficked into the European Union each year, the majority for the sex trade." The New York Times continued, "As many as 50,000 women and children from Asia, Latin America, and Eastern Europe are brought to the United States under false pretenses each year and forced to work as prostitutes, abused laborers, or servants, according to a Central Intelligence Agency report that is the government's first comprehensive assessment of the problem. Many of the women and children are sold by indebted parents from countries whose economies have been devastated through corporatocracy policies. As the corporatocracy knows full well, debt is a powerful weapon. The fear of being forced out of our homes and losing our cars and retirement funds, as well as the humiliation of bearing the scarlet letter B, bankrupt, is hammered into most of us from an early age. If you don't pay what you owe, you'll be a failure in life, we are told. Individuals are shunned as financial pariahs. Nations have sanctions imposed on them. In both cases, it becomes difficult or excessively expensive to obtain financing in the future. The power of debt was palpable when I talked with Joe Stevenson, a New York hotel worker, in the spring of 2009. "My union brothers were piling into the truck on their way to the picket lines," he told me. "I grabbed my jacket and headed out to join them. Then a man blocked my path. I recognized his face, but I couldn't quite place him. I started shaking, though I wasn't quite sure why. 'You got a big mortgage on that home of yours?' he said. 'Think your wife will stick by you if you lose it?' I have to tell you, I turned around, folded my jacket, and went back to work. I'm no hero. I just couldn't take that chance." Business people have known for a long time that workers saddled with debt think twice before quitting or protesting. Policies that encourage borrowing bust unions. President Reagan understood this. Once he entered the White House, he threw the full weight of his office behind the anti-union business leaders who had financed his campaign. In the summer of 1981, he fired more than 12,000 striking air traffic controllers. It demolished their union. Then Reagan appointed dedicated union foes to head the federal agencies that were supposed to protect the rights of workers. According to John Jordan, president of the Washington public relations firm Principor Communications and a union organizer for 10 years, interviewed in 2004, Reagan's actions really opened the floodgates to a major effort on the part of corporate America to essentially beat labor back into a corner to a place where they haven't recovered yet. But the Reagan administration's most effective war against labor was waged through debt. Laws the president advocated deceived borrowers into believing they were getting low-interest rate loans when, in fact, the opposite was the case. Balloon payment and adjustable rate mortgages and other technically complex loan packages were created that confused consumers. The higher overall rates made it increasingly difficult for those with credit card and home equity debt to pay off their loans. It happened to people regardless of income level. "I thought I was sitting pretty," a noted psychiatrist in Palm Beach County, Florida, told me. "I took out a mortgage and bought a house for $1.5 million. A few years later, it was appraised at $2.3 million. I took another loan based on the increased value and bought myself a boat. A year later, the housing market crashed. They tell me now my house is worth about 50% of what I paid. My business has fallen off. I'm going to have to file for bankruptcy. I'll probably lose everything." Laws passed as a result of the Great Depression capped interest rates and effectively protected us against the evil banker portrayed in the old black-and-white film. All that changed with a 1978 Supreme Court decision, Marquette National Bank v. First of Omaha Service Corp., that was used a few years later under the Reagan administration to overturn anti-usury laws. Beginning in 1981 with Citibank, credit card interest rates began to climb. The trend continued for the next 27 years. Neither Democrats nor Republicans did anything to discourage it. By 2008, banks were charging as much as 35% annual interest on credit card debt. Others were charging much more, legally. The Associated Press reported, April 2, 2009, "Payday loans are small, very short-term loans with extremely high interest rates that are effectively advances on a borrower's next paycheck. They're typically obtained when a borrower goes to a check-cashing outlet or an online equivalent, pays a fee, and writes a post-dated check that the company agrees not to cash until the customer's payday. Finance charges typically amount to annual interest rates in the triple digits, around 400%, and can go as high as double that. Our obsession with lending money and earning higher interest rates has impacted the fundamental structure of the U.S. economy. The nation has suffered under a massive exodus of funds from manufacturing into the financial sector. Because returns on stocks declined while those from loans skyrocketed, the economy flip-flopped from production to paper shuffling. The business of mergers, acquisitions, derivatives, and hedge funds rose while the auto, steel, and other industries collapsed. We believed in the inherent goodness of business and government leaders. We accepted their advice, mortgaged to the hilt, put our 401ks and other savings into mutual funds, and watched our economy and our savings implode. It seems incredible as we look back to think that we allowed a few CEOs and senior partners in the financial world to bet huge amounts of our money, reaping tens of millions in bonuses based on their phantom profits, while we rushed headlong into insolvency. Rafael Correa's experiences as a capitalist economist who rose to become president of Ecuador give him a unique perspective on all of this. He made an impassioned plea for change on June 25, 2009, as the UN General Assembly debated possible new rules to deal with the global economic crisis. Discussions swirled around a proposal for increasing aid to poorer nations, tightening regulation of financial instruments, and reforming the IMF and other multilateral institutions. Correa called for abolishing the IMF altogether. He added, "We who want to be citizens of the world cannot understand schemes that always end up trampling and enslaving the poorest. How can we understand so-called globalization that does not seek to create world citizens, but only consumers? It does not seek to create a global society, just a global market." The schemes Ecuador's president referred to are the brain children of today's squadron of robber barons. Most of them make the potentates of old, the Shah of Iran, and the King of Saudi Arabia look like paupers. Their stories are truly amazing.